Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 121. And we, as you can hear, are not in our usual place, in Norbury.
No.
The centre of Bristol.
No mooing cows
and
here.
The epicentre of the crime writing world. Crime Fest 2023.
Yes, the epicentre of the crime writing world we are.
Welcome to the show. My name's Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Closing Taxi Doors. No, we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Suspense.
Mysteries.
Crime.
And thrillers. And it's a delight to be speaking to you from Bristol Crime Fest 2023. Another cracking festival. Some wonderful names here. Great to actually rub shoulders with people who've been on the podcast, people who may come on the podcast, and our own Hobeck authors.
And each other, obviously.
Yes, yes. We've tried to avoid each other as much as possible. But here we are, doing a podcast together again.
Again.
And our guest this week is Rachel Corsini, who is a debut author whose book comes out the day after this podcast.
Yes, 16th of May.
So we're delighted to speak to Rachel from Long Island, New York, and it was a terrific interview. Really, you know, inspirational. She's got a great story to tell, and her new book, which is Sushi and Sea Lions, comes out on Tuesday. So more about Rachel a little later in the show. Let's get into some news, shall we?
Yes, so last week we talked about the Penguin Random House closing down, announcing they're going to close down Grantham, the book distributor. Now, I think we only really talked about that as a news item in itself. We didn't really think about the wider implications.
No, I think we mentioned it a little, actually. I did say that, you know, that it would affect independent publishers and they'd have to find a new home to get their distribution sorted out and their sales representation. But that's very, very clear now, because there's quite a number of names of publishers familiar to us who are going to be affected.
Yes, and they're now talking about, firstly, the fact that there was no warning of this, so it was a shock to them. And, you know, suddenly to be told that a distributor you've been using for 15 years is shutting down is a big shock. And there's a lot of admin you have to go through in order to find another home for your books. And also the other distributor companies are saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, we can't cope with the volume of smaller publishers coming to us, approaching us. We have to look at their lists, we have to consider, you know, the logistics of everything before we even make a decision. Now, you and I know that this relationship isn't a straightforward sign a piece of paper, you're our distributor, you know, that they have to consider all sorts of elements about it and whether it's good for them to take you on, as well as whether they are good for you. So it's a bit chaotic.
I mean, well, absolutely. We are in the process of speaking to one of said distributors and marketeers for our paperback books. And, I mean, there will be a natural impact because they were considering, you know, whether we were a good fit for them. And we're not quite there yet. And the fact is that suddenly a lot of other publishers are going to be looking for the same route.
Yeah.
So that might have an impact on us. But I think the wider thing is just as I anticipated when I mentioned this last week, exactly that. There's an awful lot of the independent publishing industry has had a curveball thrown at them very unexpectedly. There's a large tour group right opposite us as they stand outside the Grand Hotel, which is here in Broad Street in Bristol.
Do you think this hotel's a focus of a, you know?
I don't know quite what might be the interest here, but the fact that there are multi-million pound selling authors within might be enough.
Oh, it might be us, you never know.
Yeah, possibly. The fact that the Hobcast is coming from this street could be a thing. The other story that we wanted to touch on, again, is another AI story, and Google had their big sort of launch for their annual products and services that they were going to highlight this year. And they have a new version of AI which is going to be launched very, very soon. And the power of it is such that the online publishing industry is very, very worried about its impact. Why is this? Well, this new search engine version that they're coming up with will potentially take away, because it's so comprehensive in the information it can draw together, and essentially write articles, bespoke articles for you. If you put in something you want to know about,
yeah,
it will create something that is so almost curated to the point where it's written by a journalist.
That's amazing.
Right? I mean, and it just means that specialist titles or anything, even general titles, who rely on advertising income because of the eyeballs they get because they write articles that people want to read, may die out simply because no longer will people go to those websites. They'll just get it from this AI.
So basically, what you're saying then, that the AI is doing the work of a journalist thinks, I want to write an article about, I don't know, black holes, say.
Yes.
And the current scientific knowledge on black holes. So they will research, and then they will put together all the information and create an article. The AI is just doing that like that for them.
Yeah, that's basically what the power of the thing, and that means that...
And it could actually be better, you could argue.
It could be. It certainly could be much more specific.
And more up-to-date.
Right, and because the power of this is such that... I've got some exciting news for you. Mr. Will Dean has just walked into view.
he's
finally here, and this is going to excite
him. Wearing the same jacket.
Yes, he is. It's a standard look. And I think that quite a number of people in that building were hoping we could be here, including you.
Donna, too. I think Donna might melt.
Indeed. Donna Morfitt, who we spent some time with this time. So, yeah, going back to that story, then, you know, you have a powerful AI who can create bespoke content, which basically means that anything, you know, in terms of magazines, newspapers, specialist magazines, fanzines, things like that, will have a lot of their revenue curtailed because they just simply won't have the traffic.
But they're only surviving by the skin of their teeth already. So
absolutely.
That's it. It's
and then you add to the thing of, you know, while we're here talking about creating fiction, there's an awful lot of people who are using ChatGPT-4, which is the new version, and Microsoft are launching a version as well, something similar, that can create plausible plots, chapters, even whole novels, depending on what you ask it to do and what to look at. So, for instance, if we uploaded 3 books by a Hoback author into the system, it could then sort of work itself around and then come up with book 4. is basically what people are using it for.
I'd like to add that we're not planning on doing that before the authors start quaking.
No, absolutely. But, for savvy, commercially minded authors who don't really care about the craft, it will be a big, big thing for them. And they can make a lot of money, churning out books which they curated. It's fascinating. But terrifying.
It is terrifying. Actually, one of our authors, I saw she posted on Facebook yesterday, this is Terry Nixon, who writes versus R.D. Nixon, asked Chatbox to create a author biography, little paragraph, and it was actually really good.
Well, there you go. It just goes to show, this is the new reality. The world has changed in the space of about the last few weeks.
It's really quick, isn't it? And it's and quite frightening how quick it is. So this time next year, when we come to Crimefest, I know they've talked about AI quite a lot here today, but I imagine the conversations will be quite different in just a year.
Totally. Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. Wherever we go, music seems to follow us.
Someone's
and
car.
I'm always trying to find somewhere where you don't have to have music. So
yeah, it's
I think
a noisy boy.
Okay. So while we have music and bustle and very famous authors gathering around us having a tab, we ought to get to our interview with Rachel Corsini. And Rachel's story, she's a former ballerina. In fact, she's a ballet teacher occasionally. She's also a creative writer.
And she teaches writing as well.
She does teach writing, absolutely. And it's been a long journey for her to... her dreams of becoming a ballerina on stage in Broadway slowly died. But, she turned her creative energy and focus towards writing. And her new book, her first book, comes out on Tuesday, and that, of course, is Sushi and Seahorse.
Lions.
I'm going to say seahorses.
I know.
Yeah, caught there. Sushi and sea lions. And it is a romantic comedy. It's quite saucy. It's got a little bit of a feel to Candice Bushnell or something like that, Sex and the City, I think.
That's a bit of a feel that the interview was like that, wasn't it? I think we touched on Sex and the City as well, didn't we?
So. Yeah, absolutely. So let's speak to Rachel Corsini.
Well, it's a great pleasure to speak to Rachel Corsini over in the United States. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Well, so are we. We really are.
Where are you? Because I love talking to people far away.
I'm in New York.
So we were looking it up. Freeport?
Yes. So I live on the South Shore of Long Island now in Freeport, which is like this kind of, it's not a beachy town, but it's a water town. Like a lot of people here have boats and like they go fishing and stuff like that. And I also live kind of by this area that's got like restaurants and bars and like things to do.
But I'm like Dawson's Creek.
You could kind of say that just a little bit. So it's a seasonal town. So like things now are kind of starting to ramp up, like, you know, because the weather is getting nice. And so like things are starting to open up again. There's a lot of seafood places. So that's really nice. But I'm originally from Queens. So yeah. I'm originally from the city. And I was born and raised there and grew up there my whole life. So I was a part of the hustle and bustle of New York City from birth.
Fantastic. And that comes through strongly in your debut novel, which as we record this is on the verge of coming out, which is fantastic.
Days, isn't it?
It is. It's like, it's 6 days away. it's like very, yeah, I know, like launch week, like this is a little bit insane. I didn't realize it was going to be like this, the hustle of it. I mean, I should have known. I really should have known that it was going to be very hectic. But Queens is a huge part of my debut novel. It takes place in Queens. Daniela, the main character, she, you know, had this whole other life on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and she returns, she has to go back to where she grew up. And so it's also, it's not just like her finding herself, it's also a return to her roots and a little bit of a renewal of a love affair with where she grew up. And that's kind of close to home for me too, because I always had this love-hate relationship with my neighborhood. Like as when I grew up and I still lived there in my late 20s and early, like very early 30s, I kind of fell in love with it again. And like the local bars and just the delis and, you know, seeing, you know, the neighborhood people and places like that. And I appreciated it more. Whereas when I was younger, I was like, I got to get out of here.
I think everybody feels like that, don't they, about where they grew up and to some degree. You think, I can't wait to explore other places and see what's beyond what I've known all my life. And
yes, it was very much like that, especially for me. And that kind of, that like wanderlust started for me when I was a lot younger. So I went to Catholic school in Queens from the time I was in kindergarten until eighth grade. And it was very, as I got into middle school and stuff, it was very restricting for me. And I was always a dancer. I was always a ballet dancer. And so I wanted to get out of there, something terrible, because I knew that like the city, like, you know, you had to go to the city, you had to go to like the big city, right? So us from Queens, from the boroughs, we call Manhattan the city. So if ever I say the city, we mean like Manhattan, right? You know, the start, like the skyline, you know, Broadway, the whole thing. So I was like, I got to go to the city. I want to be a ballet dancer. I want to be a performer. And so I auditioned for the performing arts high schools in the city, and I got into one. And so at 14 years old, I was on the trains and buses and commuting into Manhattan every day to go to school and dancing and living that life, like that artist, you know, fame life.
I was going to say, it is very much the fame. Yeah.
Yes.
I loved as a child. I absolutely loved watching Fame. I even had a Fame sticker book.
Yes. I mean, it was very much like that. And, you know, like seeing those, like those streets, like in that movie, even though it wasn't the 80s, because, you know, I graduated in like 2005. So it was like the early 2000s. But it was very much like that electricity, right? And being in those streets every single day and being a part of that, especially as a teenager, was very exciting. Like, I loved every minute of it. So that started the, I got to get out of here, the wanderlust, like the city is the place to be. It's full of artists and free thinkers and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it was fantastic. I would not change that experience for the world.
No, that's fantastic. But I mean, I went to journalism college, which was similar kind of field. No, I mean, clearly.
You're comparing Cambridge to Manhattan.
No, I'm Cardiff. Literally, well, of course, we didn't burst out of the school and jump on car bonnets and fenders and start dancing or anything like that, or play a cello on top of a taxi. Any of that stuff didn't. But I mean, there is something about being in amongst kindred spirits in the creative arts and going to something that specializes in it, where everyone's passionate about the same thing. That is something very special, isn't it?
It is. Yes. That I was surrounded by people, and you know how it is, like in high schoolers, especially, like, you know, being surrounded by, you know, people that are so passionate about what it is that they're doing and these enormous dreams, right? And these possibilities that we all had at that age. It really was very inspiring. It was a great time. Like, it was a great time now that I look back on it. So I feel like the hormones and stuff, but, you know, whatever. I mean,
that's an interesting scenario, because, you know, we all remember our teenage years being this sort of swell of hormones and all the other things that go on. But when you're in an environment like that, where everyone's got the passion and the drive and everyone is beautiful and all that stuff, it's, you know, an athletic.
Is it the same
talented
for journalism school?
No, absolutely not. One or two. But I mean, that must amplify everything and elevate the stress and the
highs and the lows.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I mean, weirdly enough, I think it prepared me to write this book. Like, because it really was a lot of like very like high highs and low lows, and, you know, the crying and the, is this what I want to do with my life? And, like, you know, all of these different things, and everything is so amplified, and, you know, and then you, like, I would see like other people like my age, and I'd be like, wow, they're doing like such cool things. Like, I had friends who were on Broadway. Like, I had friends who were in movies. I had friends who, you know, we were 17 and graduating, and they were getting contracts for ballet companies. I mean, like, people that I knew did so many amazing things. And I was just like, it was incredible. Like, you know, I mean, some people I went to high school with are on Broadway to this day. I mean, some people are still dancing in ballet companies. I have someone that I know that is a prominent choreographer now for New York City Ballet. Like, I mean, and these are people that I shared a classroom with.
Yeah.
And it's like very, very inspiring. And, you know, and here I am, I'm like, I finally wrote my debut.
It's equally as valid, though, as all those other
ones. But, I mean,
it is.
I've got to ask the question, though, about, you know, that challenge of being in a period where everything seems possible, and actually for some of your contemporaries, yes, they've realized their dreams, but in perhaps, I mean, I don't know, but in your case, the dancing side of things or some of the creative stuff hasn't been fulfilled in the way that you hoped. Is that right?
Yeah. You know what? Yes. When I was in high school, being a dancer and, you know, being a young woman as a dancer and as wanting to be a ballet dancer was a significant challenge. And I, you know, I had a lot of critiques, like from my program, and you know, things about my body were said and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, those are like things that I couldn't change. I was like, well, you know, this is the way I look. And I, you know, I was a young girl and hormones and your body's changing and you don't, you know, all these kind of things. And so when I was graduating, and I was looking at programs and places to go, and did I still want to dance? That was really kind of, I had kind of like a breakdown, and I said, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I can't do this anymore to myself. And so I needed to like switch gears, and I'd always kept a journal, and I actually took a creative writing class in high school where I wrote like short stories. And my creative writing teacher said, you know, you have a talent for this. Like, why don't you explore this? And I was like, no, I'm a dancer. And then I was like, I'm not a dancer anymore. And then, so I applied to creative writing programs, and then I pursued that in college. And then after, so I did a creative writing program in college, and I had a piece like published in their literary supplement. And then, so speaking about like, you know, navigating your dreams, like in a weird way, like this is the whole topic. And then after that, like when I got out of college, I was like, well, I can't sit in my parents' basement and write books. Like, what am I going to do with myself? So I wanted to work in publishing, but I graduated in 2009 and there were no jobs. So I sort of like putzed around for a while. Mm. And I taught ballet and I worked as a manager in a restaurant. I was a journalist for a little while for like a local newspaper. I did that. And then I finally got a job in publishing, but it was medical publishing and it was awful.
Really? Why?
Oh my God. It was just very boring to me as a creatively minded person. And I did that for a few years. Then I was like, I got to do something else with myself. But throughout all of this, I had kind of stopped. I stopped writing creatively because it was, you know, like adulting got in the way, right? Yeah. Like I was tired. I was busy. I was running around all the time. I was, you know, all these different things. And so I kind of stopped writing. And then I went back to school to be a teacher. And I'm a teacher now. And then what sparked like the whole writing thing again was I went through a breakup that wasn't a breakup. You know, we do these things to ourselves. It's whatever. And it was dumb, but I was totally crushed. And so I was like, well, I was just like a complete mess and sobbing and whatever. And my aunt, on Christmas Day, while I was upstairs in my apartment crying because I'm Italian and we don't move out until we absolutely have to. And so I lived with my parents still, but we had like separate apartment. Like I had like a separate apartment. And she came upstairs and she was like, I know something is really wrong. And she was like, why don't you write? And I was like, well, I got to do something because I can't keep crying on this couch. And I started writing again. And that's what happened. So in a roundabout way, it just took me a long time to feel like I actually fulfilled a dream that I really wanted.
Yeah. And that is quite a transition, isn't it, though, from the physical arts, the dancing, the expression on stage, the adrenaline, to the slow burn of writing. It's a different, I mean, I appreciate it. When I'm writing.
And it's like your ballet career.
Well, clearly. I did do Scottish dancing when I was about 7 years old. Yeah,
wow.
I managed to last a few weeks.
Is that when the legs go like that?
A little bit of that. Yeah. Well, mostly it was things like the Gay Gordon and stuff like that. And,
like country dancing.
Yeah, kind of.
We used to do that at junior school as well.
Yeah,
dancing. Gentle and dosey dos and.
Well, the attraction. It sounds weird at 7 years old, was that you got to, because I was in an all boys school, you got to meet girls. And I just wanted to, not that I was interested in them in that particular time. I just wanted to sort of see what talking to girls was like.
Experience of girls.
Absolutely.
A foreign species to you.
Anyway, I digress. But it's a very different phenomenon in the sense of, it's a, you know, dancing can be a solitary pursuit, but generally speaking, it is a team effort.
Yes.
And you're moving into a very, very individual yes. side of the creative arts. So yes. how do you, I mean, you talked about the bumps and the emotional issues that you've faced making that transition, but in terms of the way your mindset is, has that been difficult?
I don't know if I would say it's been that difficult, because I did always kind of write, you know, like I always kept a journal. I was always a big reader, and I always kept a journal, and I did always kind of dabble in writing. So it was a secondary outlet for me. So I did understand kind of what that was like, but the mode of how that happens can be a little bit more difficult, because, you know, also in dance, right, you have either the class or like the choreographer who's sure. telling you this is what you do, and then you do it, right? Whereas with writing, it's all mental and internal, and it's like, you know, you have to sit down and put words to the page. Nobody is like saying like, this is the sentence you need to write.
Well, you're the choreographer.
You're the choreographer.
Yeah, and your characters are your dancers.
Yeah, it's like you're the designer, and you have to create the piece of art all on your own, and you're setting it to paper, and you're hoping that what you're writing down is the vision in your head is what people are consuming, you know? So that in that way, it's different. In that way, it's definitely different.
Absolutely. Sorry, we've got some noises off. The cat
might be able to scratching. That's
the cat is now underneath one of our seats and doing her sort of gymnastics.
She's actually upside down.
She's upside down right now. She does this. She does this most nights at this time, just to sort of keep herself fit. I mean, she's getting quite old now, but, you know, that's her way of keeping fit. Anyway,
well, we should try it then.
Absolutely not. So I love your opening line from Sushi and Sea Lions, because and I know that one reviewer has picked up on it as well. I put a great deal of stall on first lines, especially when I'm reading submissions. And if I got this one, I'd be very happy to get it. Now I can't do I can't do the accent. But I will read it anyway. So this is chapter one, Unbooted. I glanced over at Billy. I think his name was Billy. If it was, he'd be the third one since the walking boot came off. Like the three Billy goats gruff. Trip, trap, trip, trap, right into my bed. Especially after one too many Pinot Grigios. I love it. So that's a zinger of an opening.
Yeah.
How many times did you rework that, or was that just did that just come? Is that the
because it's very difficult to get the opening.
Yeah, so this actually was the fifth chapter. It was not the first chapter of the book at all, but it was always there. So that zinger, that opener, was always there. It just happened later until I actually worked with like a writing mentor, and she said to me, she's like, this is the beginning of your book. She's like, all this other stuff is beautifully written and it's great and whatever, but she's like, this is the beginning.
That's terrifically insightful, because I guess, you know, it's often the case with first novels, actually. I get the impression is this feeling that you've got to do the backstory stuff and establish the world and all that. But actually, if you come straight in on that, you've just imparted so much information about your character.
You can glean quite a lot just from that.
And the walking boot that we're talking about, so you've got your main character is a ballerina who's recovering from injury, hence the boot.
Yeah.
And she has been, how do we say this? Self healing in various ways involving alcohol and young men.
Alcohol, men, bad decisions, right? Like the tinge of humor behind that, I hope what is also picked up on is that there's like a tinge of unhappiness, right? Like, you know, that, yeah, it's funny, but probably not so great. Like that this is her, that this is how you're starting this story. Like what's happening probably isn't the best thing ever.
No, you know, but I mean, it's interesting because then you move on to saying how, you know, empty the experience is, and she's basically decided this Billy's got to shift his hook and she wants something more fulfilling, but she doesn't want the whole settling down thing.
Right.
Which is something that she's conflicted about. So, and I guess this is all part of, you know, moving from the glamour of the Upper West side to back to Queens and the grittier nature of Queens. And the more sort of real in many ways, isn't it? Because I had a friend who owned a cheese shop on the Upper West Side. And
Marcus?
No, you know, you know this person. Okay. Not Marcus, no. a friend of Marcus. And she opened a cheese shop and hoping that, you know, the well-to-do of that area would suddenly flock to this amazing cheese shop. So she had this amazing amount of stock. Her boyfriend who worked in the financial district.
Okay.
It all.
Yep.
No. Will you stop saying Marcus? It's a friend of Marcus's.
Marcus.
It didn't quite work out the way she hoped. But I mean, for people who aren't familiar with the Upper West Side, it's a completely different world to Queens, isn't it?
Oh, it's like night and day.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think like Sarah Jessica Parker lives on the Upper West Side.
Right.
Like, I mean, you know, it's beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. And like, do I still go there? Yes. But like Lincoln Center is not far from there. You have Columbus Circle. Everything is very, you know, you have the beautiful brownstone apartments. I mean, just, you know, the restaurants, you know, Magnolia Cupcakes, like, you know, things like that. I mean, you could get a $7 ice cream. It's like, yeah. But that's normal, right? For the, and the shop for the Upper West Side, like this is like the lifestyle that's up there. And, you know, Queens, and especially there's very different pockets of Queens, but the area that's highlighted in my book is very much a working class neighborhood of, you know, blue collar workers, you know, teachers and FDNY and, you know, NYPD and bus drivers and, you know, hardworking, down to earth people. And that's like the stock that Daniela comes from. And ended up in this very, I guess, very wealthy circle because of the art form that became her career. You know, the ballet itself is, I mean, that's the stock that I come from in Queens, right? You know, my dad was a locksmith for almost 50 years. And his shop was, cat, squirrel. But, and his shop was, his store, his locksmith business was in Queens. And he ran that for almost 50 years. And that was, you know, our bread and butter. And I just happened to be a ballerina, you know, and like this super expensive, very, prestigious thing that like I fell in love with and decided I wanted to do. And it's a totally different world. I mean, and some of the people that like, you know, in that you're in class with too, are from an entirely different world. And it was very interesting to navigate that. That was also very interesting.
So we've taken it back to Queens.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a romance and it's quite steamy in places, I gather from one review I read.
Yes.
Can't wait to read it. Let's talk about the love interest then. What's he, who's he, and how does that relationship, you know, get together and then weave its way, you know, apart and back together and all that stuff?
So Vincent Labate is his name. They're both Italian, shocker.
Right.
Both Italian, originally from Queens. Vincent Labate is a recently divorced, single dad. You know, he's like a your standard, like, you know, kid on the weekend, every other weekend, like, you know, now kind of thing. But recently divorced. So he's kind of also navigating that. He had to move out of his beautiful home on Long Island and move back in with his mother in Queens. So he's a hot, also a steaming hot mess. But he's very much Daniela's opposite. He comes across as much more buttoned up. He's more logically thinking. He's a little bit more stoic. At one point, I think she says that he kind of has like one-worded grunting answers. I think he's more quiet than her. And he's kind of like the yin to her yang. So if you want to talk like a little bit of trope talk, he's like the grumpy sunshine. He comes across as a little bit grumpy, and way more, yeah, like way more reserved than her. And he's also her brother's best friend. So that's how they reconnect. That's how they reconnect. They go out. She goes out for her brother's birthday party to their local joint, like, you know, hole in the wall bar that they've been hanging out in since they're 15 and 16 years old. And Vincent is there. And so that's where they like see each other again. And, but she doesn't really realize that he's divorced or whatever. She just kind of thinks that he's out, but, you know, she gets the feels and, you know, she's like, God, like, don't like crushes ever die? Like, I used to have a crush on him when I was like 16, you know, like, you know, whatever. And so, yeah. And that's how they reconnect. But he's, you know, there is a review, cause yes, I know I've read my reviews. You really shouldn't, but I have. There was a review that said that, and she calls him Vin Vin, which is like really cute, but which is a review that said Vin Vin is the standard, has become the standard among men, and you shouldn't settle for any less.
He's a
and I was
smart.
Like, I was fantastic. Like, yeah.
How would you match up to a Vin Vin?
I don't know. Well, come back to me on that.
Grunt.
I do grunt.
You're not logical.
No, in no way. I'm not stoic either, really.
No, you're the opposite. No.
He's very grounding. Like, for whatever, even though he's kind of a disaster at first, and like he does make some dumb decisions, but he, for her, who is, you know, can be seen as like, you know, this, you know, want dreamy, like creative that she is, he's very grounding. Like, he's like a calming presence to her.
Mm.
Right. Yeah,
that sounds. It's a fascinating dynamic, and I can't wait to read it. To be perfectly honest, let's talk about the sense of fulfillment. You're now on the cusp of getting this published, and it's coming out in you know, we're talking a matter of hours, a few sleeps before it's out.
Yeah. You can tell we have children. Yeah,
but I did catch one of your Instagram posts where you were speaking and talking about how should you approach it? How should you judge whether it's successful or not? How should you be feeling about it? And I can understand that.
It's very bizarre. Like I definitely said in the Instagram post, I was like, you know, I'm excited, but like I'm tempering expectations because it is my debut and I don't really, and I'm with Creative Danes Media, which is a small press, and it's been wonderful, but you know, it's very different than like popping out from HarperCollins, you know.
Yeah.
It's different, very different. And also, like, I remember I said, I'm like, you know, it is a Tuesday. I have to go to work. Like, I can't just like sit at home and like be like, my book launched today. So it's like, it's this crazy dream thing is happening, but then I have to go to work. It's so odd. It's like so odd.
Yeah, that is grounding, isn't it? I mean,
we're a small publisher as well, so we know, you know, when our authors publish a book, we try and generate as much excitement as we can, but it's just an ordinary day.
Yeah, it's very weird. It's just a very, very weird feeling. I'm like, okay. I think
it's a huge achievement. I mean, yeah. You know, there are so many millions of people around the world who would say, if you, you know, bucket list things to achieve, writing a book. And yet, so
my bucket list.
And even though there are thousands of titles published every day worldwide, it's still a massive achievement because actually not many people get to that point. And so that's fulfilling in itself. But it is a difficult thing because for a lot of people, and we've got first time authors for whom the experience has been a bit mixed, really.
Yeah.
There's the excitement of being picked up by a publisher like ourselves. There's the thing about it coming out. And then it's the, oh.
It's like boxing, well, but after Christmas feeling.
Yeah, the Boxing Day feeling, so, I suppose.
You have the build up to Christmas. It's all exciting. Christmas Day is exciting. And then it's like, oh, I've opened all my presents.
Or once you've got married, the day after a wedding, it, you know, all that build up.
You know, there's
melancholy.
Yes, I don't think anyone really talks about that. Like, because yes, there has been like, you know, I've been like marketing and publishing, like, you know, putting things out there and like pre-order the book and like blah, 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 and like, it's coming out and like all this like hype. And then, you know, Tuesday, it's kind of like, well, what happens now? It's out. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, write another, I know, I am writing another book. It's just been, you know, again, there's a lot of like these learning processes that are happening. And, you know, being a debut and, you know, doing things like this, and then, you know, like the social media and, you know, writing blog posts or, you know, different things like that. Like the side stuff that like also takes up your time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so now it's like trying to blend all of that in and get all of that done. And then also continue to write.
Yeah.
It's also and work. Focus, isn't it? Because if you're doing all the social media stuff, which is quite sort of high excitement, but then sitting down and thinking, right, calm, right. It's quite difficult.
And you know, and I mean, like, I have a job. Like, I also I'm a teacher. I also work. So it's like, you know, like it's 8 o'clock at night and I'm like, man, I didn't write anything today, but I did this, X, Y, Z, A, B. And I'm like, you know, but the other book is being worked on, albeit slowly. It is being slowly plucked away at. I would say, I think I'm about halfway through the first draft. So I'm not that far off. I'm not that far off.
Well, I mean, that's a tough thing to manage all that. The noises increase, the distractions. Yeah, I think that's, you know, and letting things settle again and then finding that creative energy, that burst that takes you over the line with the next one.
Yeah.
You know, it has in our experience taken some of our authors a couple of years to get to that point, actually.
Yeah, second book syndrome. It's a real,
you know, I would say that we kind of anticipated that as publishers, that, you know, sometimes that's what it will take. Other people will write 4 in a year, but
they're machines. They're not, I think they're doing it by AI. They must be.
No, they're not.
But that, what you just said, like the second book syndrome, like I have other, like I have friends who are 2023 debuts as well. And, you know, we have all had this conversation. Every single one of us, they are like, what is it about the second book? Whether it's a sequel, whether it's a standalone, whether it's whether it's like in the same universe, but can be read alone or not. I don't really know exactly what you told those, but like, you know, they're like, what is it about book 2? It's like, they're like, oh my God, it's taking forever. And I was like, you too. It's not just me.
Needs to be a support group, doesn't it? For second book syndrome.
It does.
It's a disease. It's a disease. It's like a real thing. I was like, oh my God, I forgot how to write a book. I don't know.
Well, I think you should, yeah, you know, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because once you get to the end of one, you do forget. And I find the same when I'm narrating. So narrating audiobooks, and that first probably 2 hours worth of audio is absolute hell. It is, because you forget how much concentration it takes. You need to get back into the rhythm of it. You need the stamina. And you need to get into the flow of the author and create the characters and all that sort of thing. It's really, really hard. And it's funny, it always surprises me when I get towards about the 70% mark of a book, when I've, you know, got 70% recorded. The last 30% takes a fraction of the time. You know, the momentum just carries me there. But getting to that point.
Yeah. It's like, I'm like, man, I feel dumb. I'm like, what is happening?
Well, look,
it'll get there. It'll get there. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I will finish it. And, you know, I'm just kind of I'm marching my way towards summer. And so, I will have what I like to call wall thinking time or wall staring time. That's what I call it, where it's like I can sit and I can have my coffee and I can be like, okay, you know, get up in the morning, whatever, and sit and just have time to write. Yeah,
absolutely. Because we're hurtling towards the end of this podcast, but also the launch. And yes, for people who are excited by this, and I am, and I'm going to sign up for this, even though it'll be, what time in the evening would it be? Midnight. Ooh. For us.
I think we'd like to pretend it's a virtual launch at midnight.
On Tuesday the 16th of May. Yes. So if they go to your website, which is rachelcorsini.com, you can sign up for that.
You go to bed and then get up.
Yeah, you also have, I'd love to come to your physical book launches, particularly the one that's at the ballet, Integral Badly.
Yes. Oh,
I'd love to do that.
Yeah, it's that the studio has been wonderful. I take ballet class there every Tuesday, and Miss Erin, my teacher, you know, knows that I have this book coming out, and so she said, let's do like something here. And I was like, absolutely. So it'll be like a smaller, more intimate event, but I'm also going to be working there in September. I'm going to be teaching ballet classes there.
Oh, fantastic.
So I am returning to ballet teaching, which is like one of my favorite things. I love to share my joy of ballet and dance and, you know, give my knowledge to young students and help them and, you know, and hopefully they go on to be ballet dancers, or, you know, they take away, you know, the perseverance of it and the discipline and the artistry and, you know, and I feel like just ballet like can be used for so many things, and it not just like being a ballerina. Mm. And so I'm excited. I'm excited. I'm going to be working there in September.
it sounds fantastic. So many good things to look forward to. Right.
Yeah.
Here's the tough one though. Here's the bit we've been all dreading.
You say that every week. People off. It's really scary.
I do.
It's not really scary.
If you just forgive me, I'm just going to do the voice, the introduction. Here we go. Rebecca's random question.
So last weekend we got a new king. It was this big event, right? This chap, he got a new hat, and to mark the occasion, I don't know where this came from, but somebody made a new flavor quiche and called it coronation quiche. And it's got broad beans in it and spinach, I think.
Yeah.
Which is a little interesting. So my question to you is, if somebody asked you to design a quiche for an occasion, such as your book launch, what flavor would it be?
Ooh, if I made a quiche for my book launch?
Sushi and sea lion flavor, surely.
Not sea lions.
Sea lions.
No, okay. I think they're endangered, yes.
You know what? It would probably be chicken parmesan quiche.
Ooh. Mm. Ooh, that does sound nice.
Yeah.
Why didn't we have that for the coronation? Not broad bean.
Because if anyone's listening who has read an arc or like whatever, they will know why. And it's a very funny moment in the book. And chicken parmesan quiche.
Okay. Mm. I think we should make that anyway.
Yeah, we'll bring it to your virtual launch.
Yes.
I'll come up with it.
Yes. Oh my God. That would be amazing. I mean, chicken parm is amazing. But
and I'll air freight one over.
Woo! I'm into it.
You still got a passport. You could go over anyway. My passport's expired.
Okay. Well, I'll burn all our air miles and fly over, bring it over. You're going to ask me what mine would be.
Yes, of course. What were your celebration quiche?
My celebration quiche. Gosh. I've had time to think about this as well. I'm really struggling.
It's been in the news. It's this coronation quiche.
Yeah. I think I'd probably do something a bit weird and base it around a doner kebab, the sort of thing I used to eat when I was a student.
Okay. Doner kebab quiche. Yeah.
So, you know, the That's sort of sliced lamb off the rolling thing. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm just kidding. I used to eat. The best place I ever had those was in Australia, actually, in Sydney.
Oh.
And there was a place that did them on Circular Quay, which is where all the ferries leave across the harbour, across to the other districts. Yeah. And, yeah, that was always, you know, after a few drinks, that was just perfect.
It's not very, I don't know, it's quite...
That's not very quiche-like.
Elderly, isn't it? You go out drinking and have quiche.
No, well, okay. Yeah, but based on a kebab, I mean, you can't go wrong with that.
Well, mine would be pickled cabbage, I think.
Yeah. I feel like these are very
British.
These are very English quiches. I don't know if I've ever even eaten pickled cabbage.
I had it for lunch. I have it every day. I love it.
See, this is, you know, listen. I mean, us Americans, some of the stuff where I'm like, what is what? Then yeah. Again, I probably eaten things like as an Italian American too, where you're like, what?
true. That's, I mean, but you know,
I do have a strange taste in food anyway, because you don't eat pickled cabbage very often, do you?
No, I don't. No. But you know, that's your thing. I'm very sweet toothed. So.
Yeah, we're very different. You see, I'd rather eat cheese and chocolate any day.
Cheese and chocolate. I'm down for that. Cheese and chocolate. Oh yeah. But I also do have a really big sweet tooth. I do, right? But I'm like, but like a chocolatey sweet tooth. So like fudge, chocolate on chocolate. Yep. Yeah.
Put a frosting on it. I'm there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Rachel, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you. And we're really thrilled that you could join us in launch week. And we've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been fantastic. So tell us about the title of the book. And when it's available, and yeah, here's your sales pitch.
Okay, so Sushi and Sea Lions, it will be available anywhere books are sold starting on May 16th. So obviously, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, you name it, you can get it. And it is about Daniela Verdi, a former ballerina who loses her career and her situationship in one go, and she has to move back to Queens and figure out her life. So if you're into a total life collapse, go ahead.
I like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic.
We've all been there at some point.
Well, totally. Totally. I think I'm going through it now.
Yeah.
It's been such a pleasure. Rachel, thank you so much. And we wish you every success with it.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely love that interview. And yes, I am working on a chicken parmigiana quiche.
I don't know when you're going to have time, actually. No, I'm thinking about it. But...
No, because if you look at our week ahead, it's busy. First of all, we're going to be speaking to our guest for next week, who is?
Our guest next week is someone who we announced accidentally a few weeks ago. This is Jude Austin, who is a writer who lives in Japan. So I'm looking forward to speaking to Jude because I lived in Japan for a while, as everybody knows. So it'd be interesting to see... because she's quite sort of remote from the sort of English-speaking writing community over in Japan. How she manages that. So
yeah, absolutely. So Jude Austin will be speaking to her. We've got Ricardo P. Lloyd, who we introduced to you many weeks ago, came up to do some recording for us. We've got a project which we're finishing, which is Silence by Jenny Ensor for audio, and he's doing his bits for us. In fact, the day this podcast comes out. So we're going to be busy with Ricardo. And, yeah, there's plenty going on. Family-wise, people have got exams coming up. And, yeah, it's bonkers busy.
It's a busy time, yes.
It really is, yeah.
But, so actually, coming to Crime Fest feels like a holiday for me because we just sit in a bar and drink coffee and chat.
That's true. And we've had plenty of great chats. You know, say a number of Hoback authors have been here, Brian Price, Anthony Dunford, Judy Dakin have been here, and we've also had the opportunity to rub shoulders with some former guests, including Rachel McLean, and we've just presented Andrew Grant stroke
Andrew Child with coffee, which we promised him at Crime Fest last year.
Yes, because we had a long chat about his love of coffee, didn't we? And we did say to him, we'll say, we'll bring you some coffee next year, and we have.
We had to. We went on record saying that was what we were going to do. So that's been lovely, and met some new friends, and it's been valuable actually, because everyone's in the same boat here, traditionally published or indie published. The fact is, the digital tide is heading towards us all, the tsunami, and everyone's a bit worried about it, I think.
Yes, and you either ride it or you sink, you swim, or you, I don't know, you just make yourself a boat.
You do. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak to you again here on the Hobcast Book Show. We always love hearing from you, so please don't hesitate to drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook, or indeed our email address, which you can find on our website, www.hobeck.net, as a tour party goes past us again. And it would be lovely to see you there. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you have a platform that allows you to do so. But from myself, Adrian Hobart,
and myself and about 5,000 people walking past, Rebecca Collins,
thank you for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show. We'll speak to you in a week's time, but between now and then, have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.